Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 349, recorded on Friday, June 1st, 2018. Graham Cochran, The Recording Revolution. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software helping small business owners thrive. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/triangulation and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we sit down with people of all facets of the technology world. I'm Jason Howell, and I have to admit right off the top, this is one of those episodes where I put out the request for someone with somewhat selfish reasons, because I'm a huge fan, and in the music production space, I don't really get a whole lot of chance on the shows here at TWiT to talk with people about music production for whatever reason. So I'm thrilled to even get the opportunity to do that today. I'm welcoming to the show Graham Cochran, who is the founder of The Recording Revolution and so many other things. How are you doing, Graham?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. It's great to get the chance to talk with you. This is one of those moments, and I'm sure you've experienced this from people that meet with you many times. I know I have, because we do podcasts here, where someone meets you and they know so much about you and you know nothing about them.
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon, but I'm getting used to it. It's fine. I love it. I get to meet a lot of really cool people.
Yeah. Well, you do really great work. For those who aren't familiar with Graham, Graham is an audio engineer, musician, entrepreneur, educator, coach. Of course, YouTube star has kind of bubbled up along the way as well. And we'll kind of get into how that happened, because I'm assuming, you know, even 10 years ago, you know, YouTube star wasn't even a thing then. Certainly probably wasn't on your roadmap to suddenly be there.
No, not at all. Yeah, things have changed a lot.
They really have. So why don't we kind of start in the beginning and just kind of peel back a little bit. When it comes to music and audio production, I know for myself, my music passion started at a very young age. I have to imagine that it did for you as well. That maybe you have some sort of, you know, a familial background in music. But did you ever think when you were younger that your life would, that you would end up in the place that you are now as an entrepreneur in the music space?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I have no entrepreneurs in the family that I'm aware of. Not an entrepreneurial bone in my body growing up. I like stability, predictability, everything that entrepreneurism is not. Entrepreneurship is not. So it's not something I expected to fall into. Especially since all I really wanted to do was music. I didn't really get into business, or I didn't really care about making a lot of money. I just wanted to be able to do what I wanted to do for a living, which was make music. And I didn't care what way it was, whether it was an artist, which I tried to get signed on a label, or as an engineer, which was backup plan. Cause at least I could work in studios and work with other artists and make my own records. And didn't like working in a studio, actually preferred freelancing. I worked at a really big studio in Virginia, we were doing some big acts, and it was very stressful, and everybody was stressed. Everybody was angry and running around with their heads cut off. And I said, this has nothing to do with the fun of making music. This is crazy. So I'd rather make records out of my own home studio and work with artists that I want to directly. So that's the path I was on. The whole YouTube thing, business thing, kind of came later. But I was not expecting it, no.
Yeah, and sometimes, you have to be in the right position to take advantage of the fact that those opportunities present themselves, follow the path, as it were. When you were younger, with that passion for music, did creating and crafting a successful career in the music industry seem like something that was actually achievable? Or did it seem like a dream that, hey, maybe someday I'll be lucky enough to be welcomed into this life?
Yeah, it seemed like a little bit of a dream. I did feel like I was talented enough to give it a shot. You know, I would hope that my family was honest with me, unlike the people that let their poor friends and family go on American Idol and all these shows and sing awfully. I was hoping that people were at least honest with me, because my whole life I'd been told and validated, hey, you've got a voice, you can sing. Oh, yeah, you can play instruments. And so that path seemed at least worth taking a shot, because I had some natural ability. And I took advantage of it by practicing and rehearsing and writing tons of songs and playing shows as much as I could, that it was worth pursuing. I didn't expect it to be a shoe-in. I didn't think it would be very easy necessarily, but I thought I should at least give it a shot. And that was about all it was a shot.
Right, right. Do you have like a particular moment in time, kind of like an earliest music creation memory where I don't know, where that spark was lit? I mean, I imagine you were pretty musical as a kid. Where did that spark come from?
Well, my dad's a musician. He's a classically trained singer. And then he also just, so we listened to a lot of classical music growing up, but then he loved rock and roll and jazz. And so we would sit down and he would play records. We would listen to Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and then Alice in Chains, even when I was, you know, a kid, and he was starting to listen to what was new in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then, but then we would play like Pat Metheny and we would play Miles Davis and then we'd play Handel's Messiah. And it was like this wide variety of music. So we always heard music growing up. I was encouraged to sing and play, but it wasn't until high school when we had a little band, might have been middle school, early high school, where we were looking at how much money we had as a band to go into the studio and record. And it was like that moment of, we've got this amount of money, which buys us this many hours in the studio, and I don't know if that's going to be enough time to make the record we want, or we could try to buy some equipment and do it ourselves. Now, this was like way before home recording was possible, really. But we knew you could buy some equipment and we would give it a shot. So we decided to do that. That was a turning point in my life. We bought a Korg 8-track hard disk recorder, which, you know, you'll know what this is, but like before there was computer recording, and it was like a little mini thing with 8 faders. And this was the first time I realized how you could multi-track record. So I could record my guitar part and then go back and record myself singing on top of it separately and then blend the two as if I played them together. And then record harmony vocals to test out to see if they work so I could sing with myself. All of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, I can try out song ideas with this. And it became a whole new like craft for me that was just as fun as writing songs and playing, was now this third craft, which is recording and producing music. That was, I mean, I might have been 15 years old when I first got that machine. And nobody wanted to learn how to use it. I was, the only reason I learned how to use it was because nobody else wanted to, and I just wanted my music to be recorded. So I opened up the manual that wasn't written by musicians. It was written by scientists that would in Japan that made this machine that don't care about music. They cared about they were engineers, you know, like traditional sense. So I didn't understand it. It was awfully written. But I started to realize this is a whole nother thing. And that changed the course of my life, because that led me into, what can I do in college if I just want to be a rock star? And it's like, well, you can go to audio school and learn how to record music. And that led me to freelancing, which led me to the recording revolution, which led me to where I am today. So that was a big turning point of not going in the studio that 1 month, instead of buying some equipment on eBay and trying to figure it out.
Yeah, it's interesting that we think about now as being such a liberating moment in time for music production and what's attainable and affordable even. Like, it's crazy. Like, usually nowadays, if you have a computer, you have a machine on which you can record, and you might not even need to buy a single piece of software or hardware to do it. You could just do it based on the computer that you already own. But back then, like, my experience was similar. Mine was, and I hear you say 8-track, and I'm like, man, you were spoiled. I had the 4-track Tascam little, you know, cassette recorder, and you had to bounce between, you know, record 3 tracks, then bounce them onto a 4th, and it forced you to get creative. It forced you to kind of work within those limitations, and that's something that, to a certain degree, that's something that you have to challenge yourself with now if you want to experience it, and there's value to that, limiting yourself. But when you learn in that environment, that really creates a strength to your ability. So I think you're blessed and you're fortunate to have, you know, started there.
Oh, I agree, because any creative space, limitations are always the key to flourishing and creativity, which always sounds counterintuitive, but it actually makes a lot of sense, right? If you tell a painter, you know, paint me a picture of a sunset. And if that's the only instruction, then that painter has a massive question, which is, well, where and on what do you want me to paint it? Do you want me to paint it on a piece of notebook paper, an index card, or the side of a bus? Like, give me, what are my boundaries? What am I painting this on? Otherwise, I don't know how to paint it because there's no edge. There's no defined limitation. And so if you tell a painter what the canvas size is or where it is, then he or she can just create amazing art. And it's the same with music and technology. You know, I say kids these days, which makes me sound old, but kids these days have unlimited tracks, unlimited hard drive space, unlimited compressors and EQs and tools, because there's not finite amounts. If you buy a compressor for $2,000 and you got one of them, maybe you buy two. Now you got the little piece of code. You can put it on every track you want. That actually hurts them. And it's making a lot of people have a hard time making good sounding music because there's no boundaries. There's no limitations. So they just keep adding stuff without knowing what to do with it. And I think it is a lost art, not to sound like the chronological snobbery, to quote C.S. Lewis. It's not that I think I'm better. It's that there's something that could help people today in this age of unlimited to come back to having some boundaries, some finite limits, so that they can create amazing sounding recordings. And I think that's getting lost on people. But the people that catch it are catching on to it, and they realize they need those limitations.
Yeah, and those are, you know, at least I know for myself, when it comes down to challenging myself in creative ways, sometimes I have to impose temporary guidelines around how I'm working. And that's one way that's really amazing. It's a huge recommendation that I have for people when I'm talking about music production is, if you're stuck in a rut, like, trim it back, peel it back, force yourself into a position of restraint and limitation and deal with it and see what you come out on the other end. And I mean, in my experience, it's amazing what you learn in doing that. It's really hard to give into that because, like you say, we have unlimited resources now, which is amazing to be in the position where things are democratized to the point to where we have that. And that's not a bad thing. It's an amazing, great thing. But it's also valuable to kind of check out the other side too. And you actually grow when you do that.
Agreed.
So we're going to dive into kind of the transition between, you know, your earlier ideas of where your life would end up and kind of follow the path of that. Before we do, I want to take a quick minute and thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation, and that's FreshBooks, where you can streamline your business operations. If you're, you know, taking money from clients, it's not always the easiest thing in the world to do. Handling that can be very complicated, very complex, and FreshBooks makes it easier for you. It's the easy to use cloud accounting software that's built specifically for you, the small business owner. You can quickly access accounting reports in the FreshBooks dashboard and even send professional looking invoices. Doesn't take very long, in seconds. You can do it almost immediately. You can keep tabs on your business no matter where you are with the FreshBooks mobile app, easy to use app that you can find for Android and iOS. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account and also updates expenses daily. So you can import your expenses in bulk. You can take a picture of that receipt, upload it, and then let FreshBooks do all the rest. Manage team member rates and add team members as business partner or contractor, so you can kind of give them those classifications depending on which permissions that you want to grant to each team member. You can also create proposals with rich text content and images and request your client's e-signature as they happen to accept those proposals. Other income as well. You can use the revenue streams graph to know exactly where your invoice and non-invoice revenue is coming from. That's online sales and ads, that sort of stuff. That way you can accurately plan for growth and make informed decisions about how to diversify. And with FreshBooks, there's no need to chase clients for payment. You can accept online payments directly from your invoice, and that'll mean that you get paid an average of 2 times faster. You can see sent, viewed, paid, and overdue invoices, easily import clients from a CSV file with just a couple of clicks, bill for time by client and by specific project, send invoices, estimates, and proposals in multiple languages. It's all super easy here. The new Microsoft Outlook payments integration into FreshBooks actually allows users to view and pay FreshBooks invoices regardless of what device they view it from. If your credit card is registered with Outlook Payments, you can then pay in one single click. Join over 10 million people using FreshBooks to painlessly send invoices, track time, and capture expenses, and get back to doing what you love. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/triangulation and enter triangulation in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's FreshBooks.com/triangulation, and we thank FreshBooks for their support. Getting back to kind of like how this transitions into the recording revolution, I know at some point you kind of had to move from where you were. You'd done some live music recording. You were recording some of your friends. You eventually made the trek out to Florida. And actually, just real quick, I've been checking out the new VIP space on your site, and I'm loving it, by the way. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But someone awesome. On the site, I posted, like, hey, does anybody have any questions for Graham? I'm going to be interviewing him. And Dwayne Favell wanted me to ask, why did you choose he it's his understanding that you're in Miami at this point, is that right?
No, I'm in Tampa.
Tampa. Okay. All right. He put in Miami, but I think the purpose of his question, the goal of his question, is to understand why you chose Tampa. If music production is your thing and you wanted to create a life, a career out of it, was there something specific about Tampa that stood out for you as like a place to be when it comes to live music and recording music?
Well, that's a great question. Well, the answer is that I didn't move to Florida or to Tampa for the music. I moved with a bunch of friends to help start a church down here, actually. So my buddy was a pastor at a church we were going to in Virginia, and he was looking to start a church down south, and he was looking at Tampa. And I used to help out playing in the worship band at that church. And I played bass in one band, and then one service in the middle of the week, I led that band. And he was like, hey, man, do you want to do something crazy and move to Florida and be, you know, the leader of my band down there for this new church I want to start? And at the time, my wife and I were looking to move and do something different. We were up for the challenge. So we moved not for my music career, but to help out a buddy and just sort of transplant and adventure a little bit. And at the time, I was still doing freelance recording and mixing on the side. So it was like my Thursday night, Friday night, all day Saturday gig. And I was transitioning to a lot of remote mixing. So I thought, you know what, I can still keep up a lot of the mixing no matter where I live. So let's give it a shot. So I still had a day job at the time. And I moved down and just got a different job, which I ended up losing, which led to the recording revolution eventually. But yeah, that's why I moved down to Florida. It wasn't for the music production, but tied to that though, because I think it's a fair question. I think people still think you have to be in LA, Nashville, or New York,
right?
Or Miami even to make a look. Miami's a huge music town.
Absolutely.
A lot of Latin music, but a huge music town. And some of my good friends who are huge producers, they all live and work out of Miami. But you don't have to live in those towns to make a career. I think that's, again, I named my site The Recording Revolution because of the revolutionary time in which we're living with the gear being affordable and accessible. But it's also now this interconnected world where there's so much remote work happening that, yeah, a lot of people still think I live in LA. I had a vendor wanted to meet up with me to show me some new product. And they're like, I'm in LA. Can I come by your studio? I'm like, I don't live in Los Angeles. and they were so confused. Like they assume you live there, but I could live anywhere. Because I interact remotely with clients, I create content remotely, I collaborate remotely with musicians. It's a weird, lonely life, but it's also a freeing life if for quality of life purposes or day job purposes or family, you need to move somewhere else for family, you actually have that freedom. You can still be connected to the industry and live elsewhere.
How are you collaborating? Like on a musical sense, I know that like Pro Tools is one example, has some, you know, some relatively recently added features that allow you to kind of exchange projects back and forth. I know for me, like I used to be in bands when I was a kid, when I was younger, punk bands, whatever. And that in-person collaboration, like there's just something so magical about that, right? Like it's like sparks fly. If you've got the right combination of people, it's almost like you know what that other person's going to do before they do it. And everybody's on a level playing field. It more and more over time, as so much of this has become this like insular me in my own project studio or someone in their own project studio sort of thing, you lose that collaborative kind of energy. And how how is it possible to kind of regain that in a similar way when you're talking about what you're talking about through the recording revolution?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's the one thing that's missing. I mean, you can't completely duplicate the human connection online. So there's the pros and the cons of it. I think, so for me personally, I can still work off ideas. So if I collaborate, so for example, last year, I collaborated with my friend, Ill Factor is his music name, but Ivan Coraliza. So he's a producer out of Miami, and he's worked with everybody like Justin Timberlake and Sia and all these, and Jason Derulo, and he's written songs for video games and movies. And he's just a really creative guy, and he does totally different music than I do, a lot of electronic production. But we're good friends, and we like each other, respect each other. But, you know, he had actually sent me a song that he was working on for a video game to pitch to a company. And he recorded some scratch vocals on it just with a melody, like no lyrics, just as a demo. And he sent it to me just to get some feedback as a friend. What do you think of the song idea? I'm going to pitch it to Ubisoft or whoever he's pitching it to. So I listened to it and I said, dude, this song is awesome, but you need to let me sing on it because your vocals need some help. Let me sing on it. And it was just, I threw it out there. I was like, let me sing on it and I'd love to help you finish it, add some guitars or something. And I thought he was going to say no. But he agreed to it. He's like, yeah, let's try it. And so he had already started the song. It was like 75% of the way there. I finished writing lyrics, sang all the vocals, layered some vocals, and then played guitar on the whole song. And then I ended up mixing it. And then we did that song remotely. And it was really cool. It didn't work out for the video game, so we kept it as a track for us. And it was really neat that actually the Jimmy Fallon show picked it up and played it live. His band, The Roots, mm-hmm. played it live on one episode for some walkout music for Bryan Cranston, I think, for his movie.
That's awesome.
So it's cool. It got picked up and got used for a little bit. But we had a lot of fun collaborating remotely. But we had so much fun on that song because it blended our two genres. I do rock. He does EDM stuff. So we said, let's write some more songs. And I was in Miami for a speaking event, and I was like, let me come over and let's just work on some music together. So I went over to his studio, and in 3 hours, we wrote like 3 or 4 song ideas and demoed a lot of them, which is what you were talking about. In that moment, it's so much faster. I'm like, oh, try this. Oh, I'll sing this. You do this. So, you know, both have worked even with him recently, but if you can get in person, obviously it works faster. But I think here's what's really neat is the remote aspect. If you can get connected to a community, if you're willing to put yourself out there and virtually meet people and toss out ideas and be willing to receive some feedback, positive or negative, if you open yourself up to that, you might be able to start collaborations remotely. And if they go well, then you can do some in-person stuff. It can be worth it if you write a song or two or three with somebody. Maybe next year you make it the effort to fly out there and meet up in person,
right.
And do some stuff for like one day or one weekend or, you know, whatever. And there's a little bit of both. So I think it can start. You can start a lot more collaborations now faster. And then the ones that go well are worth meeting up in person for if you're really committed to it and it's worth your time.
Yeah, the tools are there. The community is there. Sometimes finding that community can be the challenge, you know, the community with which to connect to. And I think a lot of people online, so many people are creating music now that their number one goal is, I just want people to hear it. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, people are very focused on what they're doing, not what other people are doing. So there needs to be a little bit of give and take as well there to find that community, actually connect with them and then be able to collaborate on the level that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about the recording revolution. Obviously, early on, you were blogging, and it kind of sounds like, from what I understand from your earlier history, you know, you had some job fluctuations. It was like, okay, well, I've got the time right now. I'm going to devote myself to writing these posts because people are always asking me what I think about this or that audio topic. And that's such an amazing moment of clarity that you had. I'm not entirely sure that you knew for certain what that was going to lead to, but what I respect about your approach on that is that you set your rules, your kind of requirements in order to satisfy that level that you've marked in the sand, that you've, you know, crossed in the sand, and you force yourself to stay with it, and slowly over time it grew. Where did that foresight come from? And were you surprised when, after all of that hard work, things started kind of accelerating the way that they did?
Oh yeah. I tell people I had no master plan and I was not like, this is what I'm going to do and it's going to totally work. It was literally like you said, I lost my job. We moved down to Florida. I took this job. It was in 2009. So the recession was in full swing and there was a new startup company. I was employee number one. And after 5 months, they ran out of money. So they're like, I'm sorry, we can't do this. So I just bought a house and just had our first baby. And so it was like the worst time to lose your job.
Sure.
So I was trying to ramp up freelance work and it was literally in between gigs. I was like, well, if I have nothing going on today or tomorrow or this week, I might as well do something to keep busy. And I thought it would be cool to start a blog only to get more clients. My wife thought it'd be cool to start a blog because I was always having friends and family and people over and answering the same questions about equipment and gear that my wife could tell you that you needed an Inbox and Pro Tools LE and you could get it for $500 and get a large diaphragm condenser microphone. My wife could spit out the basic gear requirements. But she's like, you need to just write this down once and for all and put it up on the internet so you don't have to keep answering the same questions. And I was like, well, I could do that. But also maybe if I consistently blogged about what I'm doing in the studio, it would get some traction online. Maybe some more people would find me remotely, hear my stuff, get to know me, and maybe want to hire me for one of their projects. So that was about as far as I thought it would be. I really thought I was just going to ramp up more freelance work. So it was a means to an end. And it worked. It did lead to some work, but it ended up flip-flopping where the blog – through random organic Google search, YouTube search, people started to find it. People started to connect with the content. I think they found it refreshing. I think at the time, I had nothing to lose or gain. So I was just trying to be as honest as possible about, look, you don't need to spend all this money. You could go to all the big forums right now, back in 2009, 2010, Gear Sluts and all these places. And everyone's telling you, if you want to make real recordings, you need to spend X number of dollars and it's really expensive and you need all this equipment, and they would make fun of people who had cheaper equipment. And all of that's just a bunch of, you know, nonsense. It has nothing to do with the expense of the equipment. It has everything to do with your headspace and do you understand how to use it and how good is the song and how good is the arrangement, how good are you as a performer and where did you put the microphone, not how much the microphone cost. So in my mind, I wanted to be the antithesis to that and be a voice of truth and reason in a weird space that I thought was frustrating and unhelpful. So I think that resonated with people. So I kept finding more people that kept commenting on posts and asking for more videos or more articles on stuff. And so they kept me going. But I quickly figured out that there was a hunger for this information, but I had no idea how to monetize it. And that's where I started to think like, look, I've got the time right now to write 2-3 posts a week, but this doesn't pay my bills. So at some point, if I'm getting more freelance work, I'm going to have to stop this blog unless I can find a way to monetize this content. And these days, there's a lot of helpful resources about that, how to monetize content online. You know, nine years ago, I didn't know anything about that. And there were some resources, but I wasn't aware of it. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of at a crossroads of, I got to figure out a way to monetize this if it's really going to take off and be worth my time.
How much time were you spending on these blog posts? And I mean, we'll talk about video in a second, because that's a whole other can of worms, depending on the complexity of the video, as we know. But, you know, when you're working on blog posts, that's pulling you away from, at least then, what you thought was your actual way of making money. How much time per week were you spending on 2-3 blog posts? Were you spending a lot of time on this, or trying to just like take those ideas and bang it out as fast as possible and move on?
Yeah, not a lot of time. Probably less time than I should have. But that was the funny thing, since you didn't care, since it wasn't a big thing, and since I had no expectations and I didn't owe anybody anything, it was just like, hey, here's the one thing I did. I said, maybe because I'm a weirdo, I like set like little, like you said, laws and rules and parameters for myself, just to make the discipline of making sure I do the thing I want to do. So for me, the only thing I committed to was I'm going to do 3 posts a week. Mm-hmm. And to me, that didn't seem like that a lot, because it's probably maybe an hour to write a blog post. You know, I would sit down and say, you know what, I'm going to write a post about what that you can start a home studio for $500. And I'm going to explain that you don't need all this money. And I'm going to link to, here's what you need. You need an audio interface. You need a microphone. You need headphones. I'll list it. I'll tell them what it is, why they need it, link to the most affordable options. And that was maybe an hour of my time. Publish. I don't even know if I proofread. I probably still don't proofread enough. Like typos everywhere. But it was just, it wasn't, I didn't obsess over it because it wasn't a big deal. It was like simple information in my head. Let me get it out into the public in a way that's easy to digest. So speak to someone who doesn't have a lot of technical knowledge, because A, most people don't. They're musicians first. They're not engineers first. They're musicians who are Googling how to record because they want to make their own music. And I'm the same way. I'm not a technical person. I learn what I need to know technically to accomplish what I want to accomplish creatively. But I'm a creative person, not a technical person. So to me, it was like an hour a post. So maybe 3 hours a week of actual writing. And then I would tweet out the posts and hope that people would find the tweets or reshare a tweet. And I would check my inbox if there were any emails, which there weren't many back then, of people who had questions. I would respond to some comments. So it might have been 5 hours a week, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a week. I mean, I had no job. So it was really an hour or two a day I would check in and do some of this stuff in between gigs. And to me, it didn't seem like that much.
And of course, the beauty of that is that you started so early and with such velocity that over time, all you're doing is filling your resource, your online resource, with all of these reasons, all of these hooks that a search engine like Google or any other place that people are going to find your content might actually link to it or stumble upon it. And that's just a snowball that gets bigger and bigger. Another snowball that gets bigger and bigger is YouTube. As we know, YouTube right now, it's such a huge part of the online experience, especially for, you know, like I have young children. They don't care about traditional media. They want to watch YouTube more than anything else. Mm. So there's something there. You were producing content on YouTube at a pretty early point as well, and that's worked out for you. What point was it that you realized that YouTube might actually be a valuable platform for exposing your type of content to the world?
Yeah, I mean, right at the very beginning. I mean, this was back in 2009, late 2009 is when I started blogging, October 2009. And right around early 2010, I realized I need to make some videos for two reasons. One, to write about audio is one thing, but they need to hear it and see what I'm doing in Pro Tools, in the software. You know, if I want to say, here's how you EQ your vocals to sound good. Well, can I just show you what it looks like in the screen and then turn the knob on the screen and then you can hear the difference it's making? So in my mind, it's like, I need to start doing videos. I didn't know how to do that. So I'm like, how do you capture your screen? I'm like just Googling, how do you do this? And then I figured, you know what? I should upload these to YouTube because at the time, it's still the truth today, but even at 2009, early 2010, YouTube was the second largest search engine in the world. And I thought it was huge back then. Like you said, it's only bigger now. So my mind was like, look, if I write written articles, I'll be on Google. And if I make videos, I'll be on YouTube. That's about as smart as I am. Like, I'm not that but to me, that made a lot of sense. That's where I would go for stuff. You know, if my toilet was leaking, I would get on YouTube. Show me how to fix my toilet.
Right.
So I'm assuming people would do the same thing with music. So I thought, you know what? I should be in both places. So January 2010, I decided, okay, instead of three articles a week, it'll be two written articles, one YouTube video. That way I'm making one video on YouTube a week. And I'll just commit to that for as long as I can ride this train. And that YouTube has been, it far surpassed, I think, Google traffic for me. And that's because in my niche, people learn better by watching it and hearing it, which makes sense because it's a visual and auditory, you know, feel that we're in. So people are looking on YouTube for my kind of stuff more often than on Google. And so just by the sheer number of videos I put out now, you can't not find me. And I think it's just because there's so many. But that was my logic back then, and it's worked out really well.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and I'm sure you can speak to this as well, but video editing, just as, you know, video editing versus editing text on a screen. Two completely different worlds. Did you know what you were opening yourself up for when you said, I'm going to get into video, and all of the complications that then come along with that? Because this isn't short form video either. It's longer form video.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing was most of my videos early on, and probably still cumulatively, are, you know, a screencast of what's going on the screen. So there's no cameras involved. So that makes it way faster. You just load up the software and go. And then, I mean, for years I was using, Snaps, like this program called Snaps Pro X or something that could screen capture. And it couldn't do any like zoom in or like, you know, highlighting anything. It was just like, it just captured your screen and that was it. And then I would import it into iMovie on my Mac and I would just like, do crops in to try to create a zoom on certain elements of the screen. It was really rudimentary and it was rough, but it didn't take me long because I didn't know what else to do. So I just record it. And here's the good thing. Early on, I got really good at not screwing up. I guess I have a knack for being able to just go, like press record and go and make few mistakes. So there was really little editing needed. And that has saved me to this day because I've worked with a lot of people now helping them with their content. I've realized that not everybody can do that. A lot of people tense up when the camera's on or when their record light is on. They don't think clearly because they know what they want to say, but when it's on, they just can't think clearly. They stumble over their words. And all of that is fixable. You can make a great video, but it just means more editing time. And I think I've been saved by not needing to edit myself too much. But as the years got on, I started to do more on-camera stuff. I wanted to show more stuff with placing the microphones, and that involved a lot more filming and then a lot more editing. And so my videos these days can fluctuate, but a lot of them take a lot more time than they did back then. But I think that's the good news. When you start something, you start with the easiest thing.
Yep.
For me, writing an article was easy. And then second, you know, putting up a screen recording was easy. And make it quality so that the content itself is super valuable, but there's too many people that are obsessed with, I need an intro graphic and I need, you know, background music. And you don't need things. Those things aren't what people are looking for on YouTube. They're not typing in, I want a cool video with a great intro graphic. Like that's all icing on the cake, but that's not the cake. So I just was ignorant enough to just know about the cake. I didn't know there was such things as icing. So I just made as good of a cake as I could.
It's so true. And now I'm hungry. Thank you. For cake at 10 a.m. in the morning. But it's so true, right? Like so often I will look at some of these how-tos that you find online and it takes so long for the host to even get to the topic. And, you know, a lot of the comments end up being like, you know, the time code that jumps directly to where they actually get to the thing. You don't need any of that other stuff. That makes you feel better, maybe. But anybody else, like, it's not the reason that they're tuning into your video. One question I have as far as, like, creating content for YouTube, a lot of this is walkthrough stuff. And I know from my job here that sometimes walkthrough stuff requires a lot of pre-planning so that you know step by step what's going to happen before you end up showing someone how easy it is to get from point A to point Z. How much pre-planning would you need to do to set this up? Because when you're talking about, you know, a digital audio workstation like Pro Tools, and you've got plugins on your input buses, and you've got the audio that you're changing, you know, everything has to start at one place and end in another. And you're going to have to, like, have you plotted out the entire pathway from point one to the end, or do you kind of do it on the fly?
It's a combination. I outline where I want to go. I'm an outline guy. Yeah. So like my wife, if she's creating content, she has to write it out word for word. If she's got a speech, it has to be word for word, right? So if I have a speech, it'll be like three bullet points. So I outline like, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this and then make sure I show them this. If there's a technical thing that I want to make sure it does what I am explaining it to do, I'll do it first off camera and try it to make sure it's going to do what I want it to do. But most of it, I try to keep it real off the cuff in the sense that, like, if I'm showing in my context how to, you know, EQ a guitar to sound better and you hear it better in the mix, let's say, I want them to experience the fiddling aspect of what we do. Because it's not just a formula. A lot of it is, you know, the right things, but you kind of have to fiddle with it and respond to what it's giving you. So I'll say, here's how you typically EQ a guitar. This is what we're going to try first. And I'll try something and I'll be listening to it in real time and deciding if that's working or not. So they experience that a little bit. So it's not, I'm not a fan personally of really tight tutorials where it feels like a professor saying step three, right, do this, and then right, it perfectly does that. To me, although that can be effective and there's nothing wrong with it, I never personally connected with that. I felt like it was very removed from real life, and I appreciated people who would do tutorials or training where it was like, hey, here's what to do, let's do it together. And maybe it's a little rough, a little more casual, but they still are getting to the point. So that's just a personal style thing. So that's how I make content.
Sure, sure. And then I've also read about the importance that you place on email. We think about email as this thing that's been around for as long as the internet has, and it's this old dinosaur that we just have to keep handling, or maybe we hate it and we try and practice inbox zero so that we don't have to stare at email. But I've read many interviews with you and heard you talk many times about the value of email with your business and creating that email list. Talk a little bit about that, because I'm pretty sure a lot of people, you know, that's a point that's lost on a lot of people, because we just don't think email is that important in this day and age, but it actually really is.
Yeah, I mean, any business needs to be able to stay in touch with its audience or its customers. And I think these days we think, oh, you do that with social media. So you want a lot of Facebook followers or Instagram followers. But email is the best way. So the stats show it, but then just logic would show it too. So the stats show that digital marketing, there's more revenue made through email marketing than through trying to sell through social media. So there's more money being made through email right now. So that alone should be enough. But here's the problem with social media. Well, there's multiple problems. One, trends change. You know, MySpace was the jam for many years. I don't know if anybody knows what MySpace is anymore. people had dedicated MySpace pages and all this traffic. So, you know, platforms come and go. Popularity of platforms come and go. And then the one that is just continues to prove itself to be frustrating to every brand on planet Earth is formulas and algorithms change. So Facebook changes their rules. You know, maybe 3 years ago when Facebook first started to introduce the concept of boosting posts. You know, I can give you a personal example. Back then, even I had about 100,000 followers on Facebook for the Recording Revolution. And what that meant simply was what you would think it would mean is that every time I post a new article or video on my Facebook page, it would show up in 100,000 people's feeds. Now, whether they checked Facebook that week or not, doesn't matter. I couldn't control that. Whether they scrolled past it, I don't know, but at least it showed up in their feed. And then Facebook decided to say, you know what? Let's make some more money and let's not allow all of your posts to show up to all your followers. Well, show them to just, in my case, 13%, 18%, sometimes 5% of my followers. It just doesn't go to the rest of them. Even though they've clicked, I want to see Graham's updates on Recording Revolution, they won't see it unless I hand Mark Zuckerberg some money and click, please boost my post so that my followers who have already said they want to see my content will see it. And that cut my web traffic in half one day to the next. Wow. On my monthly web traffic. And it's not because people stopped wanting to visit. It's because they stopped hearing from me. And they probably think I don't post anymore. But it's just because of Facebook changing the rules. And they have every right to change the rules, because guess what? It is their product. Facebook is their playground. And I think it's unwise to build a business on someone else's playground, because you don't have control. You don't get to make the rules. Whereas an email list, if you collect email addresses, which every big business and brand is doing, by the way, you just may not realize it, but Home Depot wants your email address. Banana Republic wants your email address. When you go to their website, they have a big pop-up and they want to give you, what, 10% off your first order. And to give you that, they want your email address. They don't want you to sign up on Facebook or Instagram. They want your email address, because they know that most people don't change email addresses. And there's no gateway between us and them. If I have your email address, if you've given it to me, I can email you whenever I want. And if you don't want those emails, you can unsubscribe whenever you want. So it's a fair relationship, but it's direct. There's no middleman saying, let's reduce the amount of emails you see. And so you got to have an email list, because you own that relationship, as opposed to renting it from Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or wherever. And things are going to continue to be in flux. So it's so important for every brand, I think, to focus on email. And it's funny because I think about bands like that I like and follow. Like, I don't know. I'll know when a band's new album comes out because I'm on their email list. And I don't know when I signed up for their email list. I don't even remember that. But I'll get an email saying, hey, like Thrice has a new album coming out. And I'm like, oh, cool. Mm-hmm. I would never even know because I don't follow them anymore. I've cleared my who I follow so many times. But I'll get an inbox, a notification that there's a new album coming out from one of my favorite bands. And I'll go check it out. So email is still the most direct way to contact people that you care about, even if they're not customers, turn them into customers, and you have control. And that's the big aspect that people forget.
Yeah, I think that's so important for anyone that's trying to run a business online, be it independent or a major business online. I think that's an element that's easy to overlook. But man, you're absolutely right. It's such a direct line of communication. When I think and also providing value, right? And you do a really good job of that. But what you're talking about as far as going to Home Depot and them offering you 10% off to put in your email, they're basically paying you for the ability to have your email address in that sense. They're saying, we will pay you 10% of whatever that product was so that we can then have your email and stay in touch with you. You offer value by offering kind of like ebooks around a very particular type of topic that, you know, people in the music industry and especially the kind of the home studio connoisseurs, you know, are interested in learning about. And that value is worth handing the email address over, and, you know, then they get extended value from there. Real quick, because we do have to thank the sponsor of this episode, and then I've got a few kind of final questions because I know we're kind of coming close to the end, and I will say, man, I would love to have you back again because I did not get to even like a fifth of the questions I have for you. But anyways, real quick, this episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Ring Video Doorbell. I have a Ring at home. I love it. I've also got the chime in a couple of rooms. So no matter where I'm at in the house, I know when someone's at the front door. Absolutely love it. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. And the Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and speak to intruders on your smartphone from anywhere. You can even share video clips with neighbors using the Ring app. It's almost like it's its own social network for your neighborhood, and lets you kind of keep tabs on how safe any of those issues that might arise in your neighborhood that you might want to know about for your own security at home. You'll definitely want to head over to Ring's Twitter account because they have a bunch of clips that are pulled from these Ring devices around the country. Here, what you're looking at was recorded through a Ring. This dog got out the gate
and
the owner used the Ring to talk to the dog and say, hey, get back inside. And the dog listened. That's awesome. You can't do that with a normal doorbell. You're going to need the Ring Video Doorbell in order to do it. See, he pulls up and closes the door, and the dog is home safe and sound. Ring's floodlight and spotlight cam let you build a ring of security around your home. Just like Ring's video doorbell, floodlight cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. I actually happen to have one right here. It's a nice size floodlight cam. You got the camera on the front and then the big floodlights on the side that can come on as needed with a little motion sensor down at the bottom. Really great kit there. High visibility floodlights, HD video, two-way audio through these. So you know exactly what you need to know when you need to know it. It lets you know the moment someone steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off a loud alarm right from your phone. Super powerful. When things go bump in the night, you're going to immediately know what it is. Ring floodlight cams offer the ultimate in home security. Thieves, obviously, they just can't hide when you've got a Ring. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security kit, which includes a Ring video doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. And connect your Ring video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. So stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Save up to $150 on a Ring of Security kit at ring.com/triangulation. That's ring.com/triangulation. $150 off when you go to ring.com/triangulation. All right, let's jump back into the interview with Graham. So I really want to make sure that we spend some time talking a little bit about community, because when you're talking about the home production ecosystem, at least for myself, I can speak from my own experience, very used to like working within my own confines, which is I'm a busy guy. I've got stuff, you know, from between job and family and a whole bunch of other things. That means that if I want to work in music production, it happens late at night because that's literally the only time that I have to do it. That can be very isolating, right? It can be, we've like backed ourselves into this corner where, yes, we're able to do it, but we're kind of isolated from the rest of the industry. And I know that you very recently, within the last week, I think it was, you rolled out a new feature to the Recording Revolution site called Recording Revolution VIP. I've been playing around with that for the last 3 or 4 days. And now in the evening times, I'm spending an hour, you know, communicating with other people and talking about these topics. And it's a really great kind of resource for that, for meeting, collaborating, all that kind of stuff. Talk a little bit about the importance of community and why that needs to happen, even when we are bedroom producers, let's say.
Oh yeah, there's so many reasons why. So one is just to be encouraged, because like you said, I think a lot of my followers would identify with you. They work on music alone. It's not their primary day job, so they have to fit it in nights and weekends. It's fun. It's a hobby, but they don't get to collaborate with people. So they feel isolated, and sometimes it's discouraging. And sometimes you don't know if you're good or not, or if you're making progress. So having some community to be able to post a mix, let's say inside the VIP community, and say, hey, any feedback on this? And someone say, you know what? Like the vocals sound really great, but I would turn down the drums, or I would do this. Just one response like that can be life-changing, as you go, wow, I don't suck completely. and that can be fuel to keep going. And a lot of times as creatives or people messing with this, you need just a little boost of confidence from someone that's not your mom or your brother to tell you that you're on the right track so you don't give up, because it takes a long time to get good at anything. So that's important. I think accountability is a big piece, because a lot of times people say, they tell me I want to be writing songs, like a song a month, but you know, life gets in the way. There's a million things I say I want to do, but I don't get around to them because you have family and work and relationships. And so having other people know you a little bit and know that you said, hey, I'm working on a record, they might check in with you. Hey, how's that going? Are you keeping up with what you said you're going to do? And if you're not, it's like a little kick in the pants to keep going. That's very valuable as well. And then I think, you know, we are more, it's the weird thing, the connectivity of technology has actually made us more isolated, and we are alone. And I have people that follow me that live literally like on an island in the Indian Ocean, and there's like no one in their town but them that does music, literally. And they're literally disconnected from everybody. And even they get online and they can see all the resources and they can access my content for free, but they're not connected with other people. And so I felt like, man, I have this large niche audience, and they can't talk to each other, you know? But if they did, because my audience is filled with people that are all ends of the spectrum. You've got newbies that just stumbled into this, and then you've got Grammy winners that are producers and songwriters. And it's like, can we somehow connect these people? Because they all follow this content. And so that's what the VIP community is like, let's give a place where everyone can get together and actually connect and have a chance, because it's really, connections are what allow you to do anything in this world. No matter what business you're in, it's always about who you know, and people hate that, but it's actually great because it's all about human connection. So I'm an introvert, and so I tend to like want to be by myself, but I know if I want to make any strides in business or in music or even in my family, I have to connect with other humans. And so those who connect and those who reach out and those who add value and form relationships and become an asset to others and what they're trying to accomplish, those people win and those people become successful because they get opportunities. And it takes work, but I wanted to make the networking side of it a little bit easier for people.
Yeah, I think the challenge there is that networking as a word can be a bad word depending on who you're talking to, right? Like people will hear the word networking and think, oh, that's where I go to this party and I make sure that I talk to 10 people and let them know I'm in music production and you need to listen to my stuff. And that sounds so self-congratulatory and promotional, and I don't like to do that. But networking doesn't necessarily have to be that. It just has to be, it can be finding people who are this, you know, who are like-minded, who are facing the same challenges that you are, and learning through that and being able to have a community or another person to be able to share those frustrations with or those experiences with that understands the language that you're speaking. And through that, it's not networking. It becomes friendship, and that becomes super empowering.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Jason. Networking is really friendship.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier when you think of it that way. Find some friends. And how do you treat friends? Hopefully, you treat friends in a way that, like, look, I want you to flourish in life. So it's not all about me. So if you got a good friend, you're excited for them when they're having success. You mourn with them when they're mourning. You care about what they care about. You want to help your friends. Man, if you treat people like that, you will become very popular because you're not all about yourself. And then you actually will get the things you want. Like what is that famous quote by Zig Ziglar, right? You can have anything you want in the world as long as you help other people get what they want. Mm-hmm. And it's all focused on getting in front of people and serving them. And that's how you get known. And then opportunities seem to come your way, but it takes time. There's no magic bullet, and you have to be willing to get out of your comfort zone. If you're an introvert like me, and a lot of us in the music space are, not all of us, but I am for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't believe that we're right at the end of this interview because I have so many more questions that I wasn't able to get to. I hope to have the chance to ask you some of these at some point down the line. But why don't we end with kind of one final question that's kind of more of like a take a step back macro sort of thing, taking a look at your life and where you're at right now and the things that you've been able to do in the music industry, which a lot of outsiders would, you know, especially like bedroom producers, let's say, would say, man, I wish I could do that, but it seems so unattainable. It seems so difficult to get to that point. Looking at your life now and kind of taking a look at it from the outside, looking in, like what has been the most valuable lesson that you've learned over these years that you can impart on someone who has that perspective?
Oh, man. The lesson is, like, just commit to this for the long haul. Like, I'm not special. The only reason, I mean, it's funny. I have critics online. This is a really mean people in a space that's so uncontroversial as audio. There's so many mean people. I would never have guessed it. I don't talk about politics. It's funny how, anyway. But of my critics, if you listen to them, they'll say, like, who is this Graham? Like, he's a nobody. Like, what has he done? What music has he worked on that I know about? And the answer is, I am a nobody. I haven't worked on any music that you've probably heard of. All my clients have been smaller independent bands. The only reason I've been given opportunities like this, I think, from a functional standpoint, because there's a lot of things you can't control in life, so I'm not going to lie to you and say you can control everything, is I didn't quit making content. I just kept showing up. And everyone says that in other fields, that it sounds cliche, but it's just volume. It's just, you know, when I started making content, nobody knew I existed. There's no reason why they should, but I didn't give up. And it's weird that I didn't give up. I attribute a lot of that to a lot of just God's prompting to keep going and encouraging and supporting family. The small group of people that did follow me, I really wanted to help them and not give up on them. And they were really excited and had good questions. And without that, I probably would have given up because I wasn't making any money for 18 months. We were on food stamps. I had not enough clients coming in. It was a rough time. I probably should have just gone to Home Depot and gotten a job. And I just was like questioning my existence. Like, what am I doing? Like, where am I going in life? I'm a failed musician, it seems. I lost a job. I can't support my family. I'm blogging for no money. Like, what am I doing? And that's the only reason that I've been given opportunities now is that I'm still pumping out content every single week. And that's allowed more people to find me and lead to opportunities. So the person that's wanting to do something like this, even in a different field, it's the same thing. No one knows you unless they know you, and they won't know you unless you show up and add value for years. Mm-hmm. So start showing up, adding value. And you know what? The problem is, and you know this, Jason, is we're just impatient. Mm-hmm. We just want it all now, and we want this to go quickly. And I can't promise anybody that it'll happen quickly. Some people blow up really fast, but that's not the model that really works for most people. It's showing up for months and months and years and adding a valuable service or piece of content or a product, and eventually opportunities find themselves. So that's the biggest thing I could say is don't give up.
Yeah. Yeah, time is the only resource that you can't get back, right? Or you can't make more of.
Absolutely.
The beauty is if you set those requirements, I keep harping on this point, but it's something I'm really fired up about right now. If you set those personal requirements on your time, it might take a while, but because you're focused on the now, on the requirements that you've set before you day after day, over time, that's all cumulative and it builds up and you end up in a greater place as a result of it. And that seems to be kind of like the epitome of your career and where you're at right now. Graham, it's been awesome talking with you. Obviously, if you haven't guessed, I'm a huge fan. Your work and your words and inspiration was critical to me on the last two albums that I've done. And honestly, like they wouldn't be as where they are if it wasn't for a lot of the lessons that I learned through you. So thank you for doing what you do.
That's awesome.
And keep it up. The Recording Revolution can be found at recordingrevolution.com. Is there anywhere else that you want to point people to kind of follow the work that you're doing online?
Yeah, if anyone's interested in like making content or starting a brand or actually trying to grow a business, this year I started a whole new site called GrahamCochran.com. Not a very creative name, but and over there I'm creating videos every week on really like how I do business and how nice. I've learned how to create an online business, whether you blog or do podcasting or YouTube videos. So it's all about that sort of stuff that we were starting to talk about a little bit on content strategy and pricing and how to find out your idea and how do you sell without being sleazy. Because it's a beautiful time to be a business owner these days because of the tools, and you can create a business around your skills and entertainment and your knowledge in a way that 20 years ago was really hard to do. So that's a new resource that if you're interested in that kind of stuff, you'll find super helpful. And I just kicked it off in January and there's new content every single week there.
Man, you've got so many irons in the fire right now. I love it. Graham Cochran, thank you again. Best of luck with everything. And I will be in touch because I got a whole lot more questions for you.
Yeah, I'll come back. Let's do it. We'll keep talking.
All right. Sounds good, man. Thank you, Graham.
Thanks, Jason.
We do the show every Friday. This was recorded a little earlier than normal, 9 a.m. Pacific, but we normally do it at 3 p.m. Pacific every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. If you want to tune in live, you can always do that, twit.tv/live, or you can head over to the show page for Triangulation. That's twit.tv/TRI. There you're going to find all the episodes, all the interviews that we've done over the course of the many years that this show has been around. And if you haven't checked out some of those, there are some audio topics as well. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Dave Pensado and Herb Trawick from the Pensado's Place podcast. That was another personal, a world of inspiration that I got to explore. But there's a whole lot of other topics there. So check it out, twit.tv/TRI. And I think that's it. Thanks to our producer, Carson, for setting this up and keeping the show rolling. And we appreciate you watching each and every week. We'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Bye, everybody.